This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, November 16th. I'm Hannah Rosen, host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have June Thomas, managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So before we get going, I have a point of gratitude for you, June.
A point of gratitude. Wow.
Yeah, a point of gratitude, a thank you, as we say in English. I had kind of a crap week, just having to do with not being able to make this story I'm trying to make yield to my will. You know, it's just just creative frustration. You guys know all about it.
Yes.
And the great creative high point of my week was American Vandal, which you recommended.
Yes.
I'd been avoiding until you recommended it a couple of weeks. That is really my kind of show. I mean, that is just like a work of parody genius. I mean,
total.
Who thought to make a show about a guy vandalizing cars with dicks? And then it's just so great.
I know. There's like a point at maybe like episode, I don't know, 5 or 6 where you're like, this is just like serial, only maybe it's better. And stuff like that.
You know? Exactly.
Anyway.
Dylan is a, you know, every generation needs its Dylan. You know, like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, he's like our slacker, lovable misfit.
And that actor was so good. He completely inhabited that character.
Yeah. Anyway, so listeners, I highly recommend it. It's such a pleasure. All right. Well, today on our show, we are going to continue our discussions of sexual harassment with two case studies, very different ones. First, Roy Moore, the candidate in Alabama, who was accused of sexually molesting, hitting on, I'm not sure what the right verb is, teenage girls. The point is that the girls were quite young. And then Louis C.K., the great comedian of our age, a very complicated case study in sexual harassment. And finally, for a break from sexual harassment, we are going to talk about Amy Sedaris' new show, At Home with Amy Sedaris, which is kind of a parody of Martha Stewart, Gwyneth Paltrow, Nigella Lawson, like every kind of show that women are supposed to like to watch. And very odd. Looking forward to talking about that. And June, can you tell us about our Slate Plus segment today?
I sure can. On our Slate Plus segment this week, we'll be asking, is the Shalane Flanagan effect sexist? The New York Times had a piece this weekend about how distance runner Shalane Flanagan, who won the New York Marathon, has been a team mom to America's female distance runners. And that's a concept that you never hear bruited when we're talking about male runners. And so we're going to talk about whether that's a sexist expectation And if you're not a Slate Plus member and you'd like to hear these segments, go to slate.com/xxplus to start a 2-week trial membership. Should we also?
Do you think I'm the team mom of the podcast. Am I the team?
Oh, I thought I was the team mom.
Damn it! I was wondering who
you guys are
to be
both
team
my
mom.
Mother.
Oh, I would have done so well. I just want to mention too that before we get going, that at the end of the year we'll be doing another call-in show. And so, listeners, if you have any Is It Sexist dilemmas for us, or if you just have any questions really that you'd like answered, please give us a call at 929-266-8195. 929-266-8195. Leave us a message and maybe we'll answer your question on the air.
Also, listeners, if any of you want to make us t-shirts that say hashtag teen mom, we would appreciate that. Okay. Let's begin. Roy Moore, running for a special election seat in Alabama Senate, was recently accused by several women, we're now up to 5 in the Washington Post, of sexual misbehavior when they were teenagers. The stories involved him picking them up, taking him to their house, fondling them in different ways. These women have come forward publicly and used their names after many discussions with the Washington Post. Roy Moore has denied it, is continuing to deny it, putting the Republican Party in a very, very queasy position. Now, I got to say, part of the reason I wanted to discuss this is that it really has a feel of we're at the edge of the world, this case. Yeah. It really does. I mean, let's talk about the particulars. The particulars of the things that he's accused of doing are pretty amazing. So he was in his 30s. When he's accused of doing this. And do either of you want to describe, so I can stop talking, about exactly, you know, just give a sense of what these allegations look like and how old these women are.
Right. So he was in his 30s and he was the district attorney. I feel like that's another quite important point. And the most recent case that I've heard about is a pretty exemplary one. It's a young woman who I believe was 16. She's not the youngest woman or now woman, then girl, who's involved in this. But she worked as a waitress at like a diner type of thing. And Roy Moore would come and kind of pay attention to her. And she was very flattered by it. He would compliment her hair, et cetera, et cetera. He even signed her yearbook, signed it Roy Moore DA, just for future incrimination purposes, I guess. And then one day he offered to give her a ride home. And instead of sort of turning towards the highway, he pulled over to, I think, a sequestered parking lot and began essentially groping her, she says. And she says she resisted. And at the end, he said something to the effect of, well, you're a child. I'm the DA. No one will believe you. And then, so there are a few other, and she eventually told her mother decades later, et cetera, et cetera. And there are a few other cases like this. It has also now emerged that he was actually banned from the local mall for hitting on teenage girls so aggressively. It's pretty hard to get banned from a mall, I would say. Like that he must have been, he must have stuck out. Yeah. Am I forgetting anything in the litany of
no?
Roy
I mean,
Moore?
I think just essentially, like, you know, one of the first ones to come forward was a woman who at the time was 14, who he hit on when at the courthouse. So yeah. He was a 32-year-old ADA, and like. There's just, you know, we often talk about power differentials and, you know, that it's not about sex or it's about power. And like, this is just such a classic example of like this girl who, you know, was kind of in trouble. And this was this, you know, here was this guy who's an official of the court who, you know, in some ways her future depended on. And
she was there with her mother, right?
She was there with her mother, yeah.
And his excuse, what was it? He had asked the mother for permission?
Yeah, one of the things.
Okay, that's really important. Yeah. That's really important. Yeah. That part of really important because it explains entirely the way that the way that Alabama Republicans who have continued to support him, not all Alabama Republicans, have threaded the needle. It's his line that he said on Hannity on Fox that he can't remember any case where he didn't ask permission from the mother. That is code language. It sounds utterly absurd to to us and to many, many people, it sounds utterly absurd, but it is code in certain evangelical circles, not all evangelical circles, but certain evangelical circles for a certain kind of sanctioned courtship that I think in his twisted mind, he that's how he justified himself, that he was actually following some kind of Christian orders, which is what? Okay. So Catherine Brightbill, who was of this world, and I wrote a book about this world. It's not all evangelicals. All evangelicals describes, you know, a huge chunk of America. This is homeschool, sort of, we used to call them fundamentalist Christians. People don't use that term anymore, but this is pretty strict evangelicals. And there was a culture there, and you can read Brightbill's really great op-ed in the LA Times. She describes this culture of a kind of Christian sanction of older men courting younger women in, for what them was kind of a protective way, a kind of patriarchal protected way. You could be in your 30s and you would ask the mom's permission, and then you would, the teenage daughter would be kind of given to you. And there was apparently a famous couple who walked around and gave lectures about this. And it's you know, to us kind of horrifying. It's Handmaid's Tale. You know, it's a vision and a sense of women that we don't subscribe to at all anymore. Like, they're breeders, they're property of the men. And by the way, there are not a huge number of child marriages in the U.S., but there are something like 60,000. Like, people have written about this. There are organizations that are dedicated to stopping child marriage. It is a thing in the U.S., mm-hmm. not just among Christians, among some strict Muslims. Like, there are organizations that are still fighting to take child marriage laws off the books in certain places if you have your parents' permission. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a long speech about Christians, but it does, it just gives you a window. Like, they've threaded the needle, the way Alabamans have, the way he has. It used to be like you could say almost anything and declare yourself a Christian martyr. Like, it could always be like, oh, the outside world is accusing me of X thing, and but they're just out to get me. But not child molesting. Like, that was the one thing. That was the one line, even in prison, wherever you were, that's why I feel, that's what I mean by the edge of the earth. Yeah. That was the line that you were never supposed to cross, you know? Well, like, you could say anything. The liberal media, I cheated on my wife. They're out to get me. They're telling lies about me, but not this, you know?
And that's the thing that ultimately I have issues with, because Roy Moore, I mean, he is a piece of shit. Like, this is a guy who has, you know, there was a really, really interesting interview that Isaac Chotiner did with a journalist from, like, the Alabama newspaper group, that's kind of most easily kind of defined as AL.com. It's a whole group of regional Alabama newspapers. And he basically said, you know, he kind of went over the things that Roy Moore is famous for. You know, he put up his Ten Commandments monument, even though he knew full well that it was unconstitutional. He was removed.
And lost his job over it. Exactly. And put a bigger one.
Exactly.
Right.
Lost his job over it, put a bigger one. Then he was still reelected, even after being thrown off, to the Alabama Supreme Court. And then he again sacrificed himself because he absolutely refused to permit gay marriage, to permit same-sex marriage, even after the Supreme Court made that ruling, because he has some absolutely vile views about LGBTQ people, and is, you know, just doesn't believe that gay people are human, basically. They certainly are not, they don't have human rights. They don't have civil rights. I mean, this is a guy who's got some really grotesque views on a lot of things. He also doesn't think that Muslim Americans have the same civil rights as Christian Americans. I mean, he's just, there are so many things. And here's the thing that really bothers me about this. He's been, you know, he was elected multiple times as a judge. He didn't get to be the governor of Alabama, which he attempted. He didn't win that election, but he, you know, won this election. He won the primary against Luther Strange, the establishment candidate, the candidate that had Donald Trump's backing. He still won. The voters of Alabama have had no problem with some grotesque views that he has espoused, really grotesque views. You know, to me, this is the greatest shame. It's like, it's the citizens of Alabama as much as Roy Moore. Roy Moore is an edge case, but the people of Alabama have voted for him over and over.
And might again.
Might again, yeah. He's not going to back down. And, you know, one of my favorite podcasts is the 538 podcast, mostly for Claire Malone, Noreen Malone's sister.
Shout out, Claire.
Shout out to Claire. And she made a really good point on this week's episode, which is that, you know what, you know, Mitch McConnell and all these mainstream Republicans are opposing Roy Moore, and they're using this grotesque, admittedly, you know, incident as their, you know, Mitch McConnell believes the women, all of this. Well, you know what? They also don't want Roy Moore in the Senate. He's not going to be a good Republican. They'd almost rather have a Democrat, because the Democrat will be, you know, be out at the next election. And Roy Moore's not going to vote with them. They're probably the difference between how a Democrat from Alabama would vote and how Roy Moore would vote is not that different. He's not going to be that much more of a support to them. So nobody wants him except the people of Alabama who keep voting for him.
Well, he's even like fundraising off of this, yeah. Right? That he's being attacked not just by the left, but by the establishment Republicans. And this placed his, you know, sort of Breitbart base. The kind of upsetting thing to me, so I follow Breitbart on Twitter because I'm a journalist and I need to know what's happening. And they have just been having a field day with all of the sexual assault and harassment violation or accusations that are coming down among liberal men, right? Like Breitbart could not be more delighted about Harvey Weinstein and Louis C.K. and the sort of Hollywood grossness. But this, you know, Roy Moore is a candidate of the Breitbart wing of the Republican Party, if you even want to call it the Republican Party at this point. And there is no sort of condemnation there. It just exposes the pure hypocrisy of the moralistic, you know, the lack of moralistic stances, I suppose, in that particular political sphere. It's like, you know, the men of the left are not looking so great right now, but the left is reckoning with it. And the right seems to be unwilling to do that, at least in this specific case, and at least in this wing of the party.
Well, here's what I wonder about, and this is where I get into the, you know, the state of our nation. Do you guys think that this story could have unfolded this way even 2 years ago? See, my feeling is like we have reached a point where you can create alternate realities. We all know about those. So hard that even a story like this, where you have five women on the record who are Trump voters, etc., you know, which unfolded as a totally respectable news story, you can't get people to, you can just build an alternate universe and ask people to live inside it, which is what Breitbart does.
So you're saying he would have been gone by now 2 years ago.
Yes. Oh. I think this a few years ago, that because it's child molesting and because that's the line that we don't cross, and because none of us understand this, like whatever the hell he's talking about, ask permission from that doesn't make sense to anybody but like 20 people, you know, he would have been gone. But now people have gotten into the habit of walking into alternate realities so hard that they believe them. You know, well, so this like weird phone call that he made, that this sort of like political phone call, and this is like the weirdest part of the story, where they're doing these fake robo calls where they pretend to be someone named Bernie Bernstein. Like, how anti-Semitic is that? You know, offering to pay money to get dirt on Roy Moore. These are like,
we're not
going to
check the story, but we will publish it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a really dumbass version of what a reporter would say. But it just shows you the mechanics of, like, if we build a world and it's like just plausible enough, people can live inside it. And that is freaky.
Well, I mean, it's not just like it's been created. The president of the United States, as you know, also builds it up six times a day. Every time he talks about fake news, he's essentially saying, don't believe the truth, don't believe the newspapers. I mean, it's we shouldn't act like it's just some casual thing that's built up by people. It's been created by people in power who want power. For their ends.
Yeah, and it's like put us on the defensive. I mean, this story could not have been put together in a more exemplary way. We know that as journalists, like the slow way they got these women to go on the record, the fact they got these women to use their names, like normally
there is evidence
it would be okay to be anonymous.
Yeah, and that there's evidence from decades ago that, you know, if it was a setup, they started setting them up 38 years ago.
That yearbook. Yeah. But Hannah, to your point about whether this could have, you know, unfolded in quite this way, I keep thinking about the famous Edwin Edwards line. Edwin Edwards was the sort of irascible governor of Louisiana. Maybe he was a senator at one point. Whatever, like old school Louisiana poll, who famously said that the only way he wouldn't be reelected was if he was caught in bed with a dead girl or a live boy. And it's sort of a funny, dark joke, right? Mm-hmm. But also, maybe says something about the values of the Deep South, that, you know, yes, sexual scandal might be a bump in the road, but, you know, Roy Moore was acting as a heterosexual man. He was, you know, just going after young, nubile women. And on some level, I think that might resonate with certain voters. It's not as bad within, you know, certainly the value system that you've described as other things might be considered to be. Like,
So the women have to be eight? Like, they have to be, like,
According to Edwin Edwards, no, they have to be dead.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the fact that he signed that yearbook, you know, I mean, at the time, he was not, you know, he was an attorney. Like, he clearly had no thoughts that there was anything untoward about it.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't mean he was right, but that clearly was his mindset. And, you know, yeah. It's also, as we've been, you know, what seems like now forever, although I think it's probably been like 6 weeks, you know, this sort of, you know, this faucet force of revelations about sexual misconduct. You know, this is different because it's not a workplace situation. It's an electoral situation, which means that we're talking about, you know, the people who are deciding are the voters. And, you know, in all elections, just like, you know, just a little bit more than a year ago, when Donald Trump had these revelations made against him, when there was tape, when there was audio, you know, it was an election. So people make the decision like, well, this guy is not. And it's not quite the same with Roy Moore, because it seems like a lot of people are sticking with him. But people, you know, they don't just think, well, I don't know if I would hire him to, like, work for my company. But, well, I have to decide between him and a Democrat. And, you know, and it's just a weird form of how we adjudicate and how we respond to sexual misconduct when it's an election situation or a political situation. It's weird.
Well, then people were literally comparing him to Joseph. This was my, like, favorite / least favorite
person.
Moment.
Person. Okay.
So Alabama, I think, state legislator said, well, you know, there are lots of biblical couples that are like this. You know, there's of course, Mary and Joseph. Mary was a teenage girl. Joseph was an adult carpenter. And my favorite tweet came from Slate's own Gabe Roth, who was like, you know, the point of your religion is that he didn't fuck her. Like, you know that, right? Which is, I think, a very good point that Christians all the world over should consider as they think about the Roy Moore case.
If any of our listeners are from Alabama, send us an email, xxgapfest@slate.com, or better yet, call into our next call-in show and ask us a question that helps us figure out what is going on in Alabama.
That number is 929-266-8195.
Let's move on to our next topic, Louis C.K., an entirely different case study. But first, a word from a sponsor. All right, Louis C.K., a very, very complicated case study of sexual harassment. So there have been rumors circulating about him for years. There was even a short story in Gawker that did not meet the usual Washington Post journalistic standards about him masturbating in front of other women, other comedians who he invited into his room. And now those rumors are confirmed. I would say no one is surprised. Right? Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah.
I think people in America are surprised.
Oh, yeah.
I think within the comedy community, people are not surprised.
Yeah. I mean, when we talked about One Mississippi, we talked about how, you know, there's a scene where a guy is masturbating in front of someone and how that was a reference to Louis C.K. I mean, we talked about it on our podcast.
That's true.
So maybe if we're saying people aren't surprised, because it is true that in all the female, there are a lot of women reviewers who were asked to write about this, a lot of them, both at Slate, at the New York Times. You feel like everyone who was writing about the Louis C.K. case was female. There was a sense of disillusionment that we basically had allowed ourselves to deeply admire Louis C.K., even though it seemed like in his comedy, he was highly self-aware of the perverse sexual dynamics between men and women, enacted them and talked about them all the time. And, like, maybe the nub of his comedy was about what it's like to be trapped in a kind of male body with its gross impulses. So we knew that about him, right? I mean, he did have a great self-awareness of these issues.
Right. And I think that's what people loved about him most, which is why I've been a little bit puzzled by the reaction to this. I don't know if you guys feel the same way. Everyone is sort of like, it's so surprising. Everything looks different now. And it does, but it also doesn't. Like, he, okay, so he actually acted on this stuff that he was talking about. I guess that does make a difference. And I do certainly feel revolted in a way that I didn't by his comedy before, but it's not as surprising as everyone seems to think. And like, everyone's like, oh, he, you know, it was such a like, you know, he was so overconfident. He thought no one would ever call him on it. That's why he made this movie, I Love You, Daddy. That's sort of a riff on Woody Allen. That's why he made all these jokes about masturbation. To me, it's like, no, this man wanted to get caught. He, like, something about his psychosexual desire is that he needs to be shamed. You know, he wasn't, he in these encounters, he was masturbating in front of the women. He's done comedy bits about how masturbation is embarrassing and gross and, like, this sort of disgusting act. And yet that was what he wanted to do in front of women. He wants to be humiliated on some level. I think he's been like tempting fate for years on purpose.
Yeah, it sure seems that way now, doesn't it?
That is a really interesting view. So maybe the maybe then the discussion to have is in that fine line, the discussion about us, like what were we thinking? We, the viewers of Louis C.K., what did we think was going on the screen, or what did we convince ourselves was going on? Well, I think what we convinced ourselves was going on maybe was that he was, the thing that was admirable about him was that he confessed to these horrible impulses and then worked them out mm-hmm. in a way that we found admirable, which was creatively. Like, here is an evolved man, because this evolved man is able to, like, see himself clearly and turn it into beautiful creative work, which says something about our culture and gender dynamics. Is that the trick is that the story we told ourselves about who he was and why we could admire him?
Was it a story? I mean, I think that was the situation, but it was the situation. You know, I mean, it. I don't know that was like a fable that we convinced ourselves of. That was true. Also, we now know for absolute sure was true, is that he was doing this sexual act as well.
I guess the fable was that we convinced ourselves he was, that instead of actually inflicting himself in this perverse way on actual women who would be actually wounded, both spiritually and professionally, by what he was doing, we thought he was doing that instead. In other words, he had figured out a way to deal with his perversion that was not harming other people, as opposed to he had continued to kind of dive into his self-involved perversion in a way that allowed himself to stay completely blind to the consequences of his actions on other people, which is not an evolved way to deal with your shit.
Well, he also, I think the specifics of it were such that, first of all, he wasn't saying, I, Louis C.K., am specifically, you know, this kind of person. He was saying, men are like this, right? And not in the hacky, like, you know.
Men are like this.
Right, exactly.
Women are not, like this.
Not that kind of way. He was sort of like, he almost seemed to be thinking about, I think what was fascinating for women in particular, for me, was that he had this deep insight into the sort of strangest corners of the male psyche. And yet also ultimately express things from almost a female point of view. Like, there's a famous bit that people have been talking about in the last week where he said, you know, I don't understand why men date women. Or by women date men, you know, men are the biggest threat to women. Like, it's like going to a safari and saying, well, maybe this lion will be nice, you know? And that, I think, resonated with a lot of women who were like, oh, this is cool. This guy is like, he understands a little bit of how we feel. And then this, of course, has a much darker tenor when you think about...
He was a lion.
He was a lion. Who
Wait, but you
be a
thought,
lion.
So you watching that, you were thinking he's better than his character. Like, it's like the Lena Dunham thing. It's like he's better than the person that he's portraying on his show, but it turns out he's worse than the person that he's portraying on his show. Because, in fact, the person on his show has a lot of, like, sticky scenes, like, when he, I mean, there's a lot of scenes where he, like, pushes a girl into the closet and she says, you're not even good at rape, or when he's about to masturbate and she's like, don't masturbate, I'm not asleep yet. Like, he really does play these things out in his show. But you somehow figured that because he could see all this clearly, he was better than the person he was portraying. And it turns out he's worse.
I guess on some level, I didn't explicitly think it through. Like, I know that is a huge part of the Louis C.K. Narrative, like, he's a good guy, he's a feminist guy, he's a good dad, he's like allowing these conversations to happen. But I think I I liked Louis C.K. and like Dana Stevens wrote about on Slate, even had a little bit of a celebrity crush on Louis C.K. Mostly because he was just really funny and subversive, and it, in a way that I liked. And I have to say that actually his show lost me the farther it got into sort of like we're gonna make a serious show about rape and gender dynamics. I sort of wasn't along for that ride. I just like jokes on TV, but I think for a lot of people, he did represent this this idea that you could be interesting and dark and yet still feminist in a man, and that's an appealing combination.
And you could do that on mainstream television, yes, cable, but you know, his FX show was out there, and you know, viewable all over the world, certainly all over America, and it did feel like it was taking a certain sensibility wider than could have been taken without that megaphone.
Can I read you guys a bit of his apology? People did not like his apology on Twitter or elsewhere. I thought it was relatively honest as these things go. But there's a portion of it that I found interesting. He says it's about consent and power. And he says, these stories are true. At the time, I said to myself that what I did was okay because I never showed a woman my dick without asking first. Seems like, you know, minimum.
Old-fashioned courtship. Can I show you my dick?
Ask your mother first.
And Roy Moore. Yeah, going the old-fashioned way. He should have asked the mom if he could show. Which is also true. But what I learned later in life, too late, is that when you have power over another person, asking them to look at your dick isn't a question. It's a predicament for them. The power I had over these women is that they admired me. People didn't like that he wrote that.
But, yeah, you know, I don't like that he wrote that either. That seems like... I do think
which part, the admired me part?
That seems like a very egocentric view of power. And then I went back and looked at the original New York Times story, and it seems like he was reacting to one particular line, one particular quote from one of these women where she said, you know, I admired his comedy. But he seemed to really seize on that and to like not think about the broader structural issues of comedy where like he had power because he was already successful and he had this agent who, you know, was incredibly powerful in the field and repped all these other comedians and sort of had the keys to the kingdom. He didn't want to think that through. He just was sort of like, the record was stuck on the, they admired me, which I thought is an interesting look into his psyche. But I'm with the people who are a little put off by that, Hannah. I don't know about this.
No, I understand it now from what you're saying. I understand it now. It failed to grasp what the full context was, which is not that it wasn't about the kind of energy in the room at the moment. Like, I'm kind of frozen in place because I admire you, so I'm going to watch you masturbate. It was fear that he wasn't reckoning with. Mm-hmm. It wasn't admiration. It was their fear that if they said anything, which turned out to be true, his powerful agent did actually tell these women not to tell the story. So what he failed to reckon with was the bigger sort of structure of power. He's talking about the intimate dynamics, which is what he tends to see, but there was a bigger superstructure which was supporting him, which he is not interested in and therefore doesn't talk about or doesn't see.
Yeah. I mean, Katie Wollman had a... I'm so sorry. God, it's such a weird thing. I never have this problem when I'm not in this room.
Or something.
Anyway, apologies. Katie Wollman had a good piece about these apologies generally, you know, which we've been talking about again now for several months of like terrible apologies. This was not a terrible apology. This was not Harvey Weinstein. This was not, you know, whatever we might have called whatever Roger Ailes or Bill O'Reilly did. But, you know, I'm so sorry. But as Katie pointed out, like pursuing consent isn't the same as receiving it. And there do seem to be, even when people like distanced, and again, this is a problem that he had for many years and that he apologized for, you know, like at least 10 years ago. So like, it wasn't like he's only realizing now that he's got this problem. He was doing this even while, you know, knowing that he shouldn't. Is that he still doesn't seem to really understand the full significance of consent.
Well, I was so interested in the fact that he had called up these women and apologized, which I don't think that any of these other men who've come out in this way have done. And, you know,
not
I don't want to give him too much credit, but I think, you know, he at some point did reckon with this. And unfortunately, he apologized for the wrong thing to one of the women, making it seem as if there are a number of these other incidents that are going to come out. But in one of those apologies, he said to one of these women, you know, I'm sorry, I used to misread people back then. And she was very, she didn't like that. She felt, from what I gleaned from the article, she felt like he was saying, well, you were giving me signals, you know, and she obviously bristled at that. But it is an interesting, that to me is maybe not this case, like, but at the heart of some of these more gray area sexual harassment kind of things that we're hearing about right now, men misreading situations seems to be a big part of it. And it was interesting to hear him use that as an excuse or an honest accounting of what he thought had happened. This like, just he thought that they were consenting and they did not think that they were, you know.
Can I dig into that? I'm a little nervous about this part of the conversation, but just let me have it with you guys because we're a safe space. It's about safety, actually. So this is not about what happened or the facts about what happened. This is about what we want to happen in the future, like what world we want to build coming out of this. Because, you know, we've had these convulsions at NPR, where I work, at the New Republic, which we've talked about, where I used to work, then all out in the culture. I mean, it just feels so, so close right now. And it feels like the world that people are trying to build out of this is a world of absolute safety. Like, we need absolute rules that govern these things. We need to know that you're safe. I mean, that came up over and over again in the meetings we had here. Like, there just needs to be safety. And that's a totally important value. But part of me actually wishes for a world where those women, where it becomes okay for those women in Louis C.K.'s room to say, like, if I think, like, future for my daughters, it's like, put your fucking dick away. I never said I wanted to see it, and fuck you, and leaves the room.
Oh, like, for sure.
I don't necessarily want safety. I don't want them to be necessarily protected from everything. I want it to be culturally possible for women to be able to, like, you know, it's the consent thing. It's that no series that I talked about that Caitlin Press did. Mm-hmm. It's like, I want to move to a world where of less pleasing and where it's just socially acceptable and kind of culturally normed for women to be absolutely clear that this is fucked up. What's going on right here? You know?
Yeah.
Not to be protected from it, just to be able to say that it's messed up.
Your dick away. I think that is actually a roundabout way of wishing for safety, because that ultimately would change the culture more than any kind of like HR rules for women to actually feel empowered to do that. I mean, I don't think anyone wants a world in which no one can flirt, no one can make a move on someone else. Like, but yeah, to just be incredibly clear about what is and isn't wanted, I think would be exciting if people felt like they could do that.
Yeah, like his agent should be afraid of those women, you know, rather than it be absolutely clear that they're going to be quiet and, you know, and that he has absolute power over them. And that's just like the place of women and the place of men. He should just be afraid that, like, if somebody takes, because, you know, they weren't working for him. I mean, lots of the women he did masturbate in front of were working for him. But these two particular women who were in the lead of the New York Times story were sort of fellow comedians at a club who he invited up to his room. So it's a little bit of a more complicated situation. His power over them was more diffuse than if they literally he was responsible for their salary, you know.
How do we get to that point though, if not through these, like, you know, talks about safety or whatever? Like, how do we want to get to that point?
And if men still think, like, I mean, I agree completely with you, Hannah, but at the same time, like, under what circumstances are men pulling out their dicks? Like, that should not really be on the table, the dick or the the thought of it. Like, yes, women should definitely be like, get rid of that thing. But why are men thinking that that's okay? And I realize it's not all men, but, like, come on.
I honestly, I had a talk with a middle school friend of mine, my middle school friend, and she and I discussed this. And it's like, you know, at 12 and 13 years old, they're already like, you know, my pants are so tight because my dick is pushing up against my pants.
Wow.
It's like there's just a certain sort of, like, and it's a, it's not, there's nothing, there's no physical assault, but there is just kind of a sense of entitlement of, like, me putting my dick up in your space. Like, even if it's just in words, like, she's, you know, they're 12 and 13 and it's just alarming to them. And that they're maybe somewhat curious about this, but they don't, but there isn't a sense that there's no female equivalent of that. There's no female equivalent of, like, I have my period and my boobies are so big and that's why my shirt is so, like, you can't imagine a middle school girl saying that, you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's just like a cultural problem.
Sure is.
Wait, did we just land on penises or a cultural problem?
Yes. The possession of them, yes. Yes.
I'm gonna lose a lot.
I mean, that's why American Vandal is so brilliant, because he's like a guy who draws dicks everywhere, and yet he's a totally sympathetic character. Yeah. Oh, boy. All right. So I need somebody give me a hopeful question to end that segment with, so our listeners do not leave us depressed with the idea of, you know, somebody's dick pushing against their libidos.
Well, I'm curious if we're going to be totally skeptical. This is not a hopeful question, but I'm curious if we're going to be totally skeptical of comedians in the Louis C.K. mode going forward, like male comedians who wrestle with the darker parts of their psyche. Will we like... Has he ruined that kind of
See,
comedy?
I guess I just think in order to be at that level of, what was the verb that you just used about it? Like wrestling?
Wrestling.
To be wrestling, there's always going to be like, oh man, this guy, he's so in touch.
But don't we want comedians to like sort of in some ways be truth tellers about the dark parts of our psyche? Like, I mean, it's like we don't need comedy people to be saints. That's part of... I mean, we don't want them to be this bad,
right?
And actively, it is totally, hurting other people. Yeah. But
I mean, it's an absolute.
I think it's you can. I think you can totally reckon with your thing. It's just there's two different things. You can wrestle with the dark parts of yourself creatively in any way that you want to, and we totally welcome it. You just can't actually make other people miserable.
Yeah.
In the world.
Mm, totally.
Like those are different things. Like there are different kinds of self reckoning and sort of dealing with your own stuff, and we all know about them. And there's one layer of dealing with your stuff, which is self involved. It's like talking about it all the time, creating stories about it. There's the next level of reckoning, which Louis C.K. is going to do in his dark home right now, which is what did my actions, you know, clearly all the men were avoiding part two, because in all the apologies, it's like, I didn't realize that what I was doing was causing these women to be miserable in the heart. They all say that.
Yeah.
And to us, it's like, you didn't, but they didn't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Apparently.
So that's part two, dudes. All right.
Get reckoning.
Here we go. Next week we have to talk about unicorns and sunshine, okay?
That unicorn is really problematic with its horn.
Do girl unicorns have horns too?
Are unicorns gendered?
No, that's a good question.
Well, oh my all God, these all questions and more we will tackle next week.
Okay, so let's move on to our next topic, a light and pleasant one, Amy Steris. But before that, a word from our second sponsor. Our next topic, At Home with Amy Sedaris, the new true TV show by the comedian Amy Sedaris about the joys of domesticity, but a parody of the joys of domesticity. This show makes fun of all of the things that we have been watching for decades and decades, we meaning women. Let's listen to a clip before we jump in where Amy Sedaris behaves, I guess, like a demented Julia child, maybe.
I have a very simple preparation for frying fish. A light dusting of flour, a little salt and pepper, and then to a hot skillet coated with olive oil. This recipe also works for chicken, known as the fish of the ground. Now, these fillets are a little big for a single portion, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut them in half. Okay, there you go. Oh, a dull knife, a cook's worst enemy. Dull knife, what am I going to do?
Okay, well, this show is odd because it has the feel of Mr. Rogers in a way. It has this kind of slow music, as you hear, and sort of her rolling from segment to segment. Like, it's not a show of this era. What did you guys think of it?
I kind of loved it, but I did find it, you know, it was interesting. We always look at a bunch of pieces. And the reviews in this case are just the kind of even the features of the profiles. There was this amazing similarity, and it was this endless use of words like bizarre and absurdist and, you know, demented. And all of those things are true. It is absolutely demented and bizarre and bananas. And it really made me laugh. But, you know, it's like, I laughed out loud, which is not something I do very frequently, but it's also not a show that I would necessarily watch if we weren't going to be talking about it. Even though it absolutely filled me with joy. I laughed. I loved it. But it's almost too odd. It's almost too odd to like make appointment television, where maybe it was that also that I was watching alone. Maybe it's a thing that would be fun to watch with other people. I just don't know. What did you think?
It had so many funny lines. Like, yeah. I wrote down a few, like, cheese will work with you if you let it. You know, they're just these moments of this absolute absurdity. It's funny. I was thinking about Maria Bamford's show when I was watching her show. And there's something sometimes so particular and so idiosyncratic about these shows. It's like the art form of creating a show that is truly and entirely yours, but having it have more broad appeal seems to be like a really difficult one. I'm not saying it's more difficult for women than it is for men. This is no more true of the, the Simon Rich show, you know, that sometimes if a comedian has such a particular vision, it's just utterly bizarre when it gets translated onto the screen. I mean, the more interesting thing is, like, what is she making fun of? Like, what is she making fun of about women? And is it a gentle portrait? I mean, this is clearly an indulgence of women.
I just want to say before we go too much further that the Simon Rich show you were talking about, was that Man Seeking Woman?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
See, I
So the Simon... Man Seeking Women is also a very odd and particular vision of a show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that she is making fun, ultimately. I mean, clearly it is referencing, you know, cooking shows, homemaking shows, home makeover shows, crafting shows. It's kind of referring back, I think, to a different age, to like local kind of, you know, these local shows, or maybe even like the little bits on morning shows where they make things. But, and so, yeah, it's kind of a parody, and certainly she goes to strange places. But you also get the sense that this really is her joy and her, just like her.
Yeah.
That it's a heightened her, but it's her.
I think she famously, like, loves to host this. She's written a couple of books about that. She clearly loves to craft. But I think she just has a totally different point of view on the point of crafting and creating worlds. Like, it's not perfection. Like, even so, the sets are extremely elaborate on this. It's this real it's sort of 60s 70s kitsch, including down to what she wears, but it's just got some offbeat touches to it. And the crafts that she does, I sort of skipped around and watched these out of order, but I think in episode 4 she makes this cake with Nick Kroll. Did you guys get this far?
I didn't watch 4.
Yes.
It's like the most, you know, disgusting looking cake you could ever imagine. And but the setup is like how you get to the cake, where she has these kids like make these weird popsicle sticks with hair on them, right? Like, it's not anything you would ever want to display in your house. And that is the point of like the sort of Martha Stewart craft thing, is that you make the most perfect little thing. To her, it seems to be like, okay, what weird impulse inside my brain am I going to work out by like gluing these things together? I think ultimately it's like an alternative view of the point of crafting.
Yeah.
That's why I think Julia Child is coming to my mind all the time, because she's not pushing back against necessarily sort of our indulgences and viewing habits, because these days, like, what are people watching? People are not watching those kind of shows necessarily. They're watching like YouTube videos about how to do your makeup perfectly, how to open a package. It's a slightly different vibe. The sort of vibe towards female beauty perfection is kind of directed in a different way right now. But it is this, you know, Julia Child was famously like messy in her, like, she's before Martha Stewart, so she would like drop things or things wouldn't come out quite right. And she was totally cool with that. And she was 6 feet tall. And it has, you know, I bet she loves Julia Child if she's going to love anyone. Because it is like, or maybe it's almost like the mystery show, the Starley Kline show, where the point is it's like the fun of doing this weirdo craft and following that place rather than the thing itself and what the thing itself looks like. Because she often looks crazy in it, too.
Which
like
is fun.
Her hair is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she also, I mean, she also, I was interested in the very first episode, she sort of is like, okay, I'm like, she creates these narratives around why she's crafting, which are kind of fun and actually like have a little bit of sly social commentary. So in the first episode, she's like, I'm making steak au poivre for one, and because I am like happy alone and single by choice. And then she has someone come over and sort of like help her out, and he comes on to her and he goes to the bathroom, and she's like, and now I'm making a romantic dinner for two. Like, just the you know, that like when you cook or when you do something in your house, that there is the sort of like fantasy element to why you were doing it, that she plays with that idea too in a way that I think is kind of smart.
Yeah, she's very conscious of the fantasy. And it, you know, it's something that one of you said about her set, which again, in all the interviews she points out, is kind of a version of her own apartment. But thinking, I was like, well, yeah, I guess it is kind of an odd space. But then when I think about like the set of where Rachel Ray does her cooking, yeah, like it's almost exactly the same. Like those are fantasies too, which, you know, when you say that, yeah, of course they are. They're these weird fantasies of cupboards full of food with fantasy labels on them. But, you know, so yes, she is definitely referencing that, but it is so demented that somehow the, like, wherever she's sticking the shiv is a little bit disguised.
Yeah.
But it's also making the fantasy, it's making the fact that it's a fantasy explicit, as opposed to just like, let's all just pretend that this is how my house looks like. Like, my fantasy of the show, when June said you might not go back to it, like as appointment television, but my fantasy of the show is that whenever I was having a dinner party or in one of my, you know, whatever, I decide that everyone's making a mess, I've got to clean everything up, I would just play that in the background just to remind myself that this whole domesticity thing is a farce, it doesn't matter and it's just a joke. And, you know, I feel like it would be kind of domestic therapy for me that, you know, this whole staging of your home is just a staging of your home. It's not real, you know?
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Although this is mostly, like, we are a little bit overthinking this.
Yeah.
I think this is mostly an aesthetic experience of a show. Like, you have to really like the Amy Sedaris thing to get into it, or at least be tolerant of the Amy Sedaris thing. I would describe myself as more on the tolerant end of the spectrum. I got into it, but, like, you gotta be there for her to watch it, to make it through it.
We should also mention that there are some amazing guest stars. I mean, we've mentioned Nick Kroll. You know, there's, like, people whose names I don't necessarily know, but I recognize their faces. There's a guy who's in Difficult People. There's a guy who was in 30 Rock. There's a guy who was in, you know, there's a lot of familiar guys from shows that I like.
Comedy people love
Comedy people. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I didn't see him in any of the episodes I've seen, but Stephen Colbert, who was with her in Strangers with Candy, is makes an appearance. So there's lots of those kind of very popular, very elite comedy types in here as well.
All right. Well, listeners, you should dip into At Home with Amy Sedaris. It is a trip to watch, and we would love to hear what you think about it.
I should also, just before we kind of, we check out of this topic, it did strike me, and maybe this is just silly, but, you know, there's in the first episode, there's a kind of a scene, it's like a sexual scene, really, where she sort of gets off. And it is so the opposite of a Louis C.K. type scene. But maybe it's too difficult to express, to talk about. But I don't know. Yeah,
can you just say what it was? You can say what it was. Right. I'm really curious. Actually,
so she slides down a banister, and like that's her boyfriend, she says, and like it's a form of masturbation, but it's not uncomfortable. It's slightly weird and like strange, and she does do it in front of someone. But it's just really different from the kind of scene that we are, you know, that would make us feel uncomfortable when a male comic was doing it. Also, it's completely absurd. So that's an element too.
Well, and it's a punchline because she, you know, she's told this visitor that she's in love and she's going to go show her, you know, who she's in love with. And you think she's going to go up to the bathroom and find this man she's invited over for dinner. And instead it's the banister.
Right, right. It's strange. But also,
all right, well,
not offensive.
Well, go ahead.
No. I finished now, really.
But also not offensive.
Yeah.
Wait, is that what you said?
Yeah.
All right. Well, listeners, we encourage you to dip into At Home with Amy Sedaris and let us know what you think of it. So we have our recommendations, but before that, let's thank our final sponsor.
Before we get to recommendations, I want to let everyone know that an old favorite Slate podcast is back. The Spoiler Specials went on hiatus for several years, but they're back, baby. Spoiler specials are not reviews of current movies. They're kind of post-views. So like audio critiques that you're supposed to listen to after you've seen the film, though I have certainly used them as a way to kind of stay informed about movies that I'm interested in, but I don't really want to see, like, for example, Mother. So Slate movie critic Dana Stevens leads these discussions of twist endings, plot holes, and kind of other secrets that you won't read in the reviews because there's an assumption that everybody who's listening is ready to be spoiled or has already seen the movie. And we sometimes talk about TV shows. Willa, Matthew Desham, and I talked about the great final season of Halt and Catch Fire a couple of episodes ago. So the kind of movies we're talking about are like It, Mother, Thor Ragnarok, and then the next one will be Justice League. You'll find a new episode every other Friday, and they're really, really fun. That's Slate Spoiler Specials.
All right, let's do our recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
I want to recommend a show that's on Netflix. Season 3 just arrived, although it's a British BBC show, so they're just 6-episode seasons. And it's W1A, which is a kind of something that we're familiar with from Britain. It's an excruciation comedy, somewhat like The Office. But it's set at the BBC when the BBC is preparing for its license renewal. And it's just, it's so funny and wonderful and also just terrible. You know, it's about a kind of an office filled with jargon and just horrific people with terrible tells. And you will also hear lots of regional British accents, including my favourite, the Welsh woman, who begins almost every sentence with, "I'm not being funny now, but..." So I do recommend W1A. It's got some amazing British actors in it too, and it's very, very funny. I'm not being funny, but it's very funny.
It's very funny. So what I'd like to recommend is a kind of a continuation of this endless conversation we've been having about sexual harassment. Sarah Wildman wrote a story in Vox, a blow-by-blow account of her sexual harassment by Leon Wieselt here at the New Republic, which we discussed a couple of weeks ago. And then Peter Beinart wrote a story in The Atlantic, which I hadn't really read anything that sounded like it. It was a real reckoning with how he had benefited from male power and privilege at the New Republic. And so both of those as a twin set of pieces are really kind of alarming and amazing to read. And then my easier recommendation, The Female Persuasion by Meg Wolitzer, which is out in the UK, but maybe not out here for a few more months. And it's about female mentorship as well as other things. She's one of my favorite novelists. So I've only read the first chapter. I will really tell you what it's about in the next couple of weeks, but I encourage you. I love Meg Wolitzer, so I would like to have a broader conversation with all of our listeners about it. So I hope you all get a copy and read it. All right, Noreen.
So I'm going to recommend two things that are both being highly praised in the culture at large right now, but I want to throw in my personal endorsement. I think they are not being overpraised at all. One is the movie Lady Bird, which is Greta Gerwig's directorial debut, which, June, you talked about on the Culture Gab Fest, I think a week ago. I really loved this movie. You know, some A.O. Scott called it almost perfect, which actually might be a bridge too far, but you know, it's set in the year that I graduated from high school, 2003. Wow. It's like, it's this, you know, suburban Catholic inflected girlhood. It's someone who, like, loves her parents, but is sort of cruel to them as a teenager and reckons with all the guilt of leaving for college. It just, like, was very much in my zone and also funny and sweet and incredibly self-assured for a debut. So even if you did not graduate from high school after a Catholic girlhood in 2003, I think that you would like this movie a lot. And then the other thing that I want to recommend is Sticky Fingers, which is Joe Hagan's absolutely fantastic biography of Jan Wenner, the founder of Rolling Stone. This is not necessarily an XXE kind of book, but the sexual politics of Rolling Stone are pretty interesting, and he explores them at length. There's sort of a, you know, it's super gossipy on Jan Wenner's sex life, but just the ambisexuality of everyone in that office and in the rock scene at that time is interesting, and particularly interesting to read against the backdrop of the sexual reckoning that we are having nationally right now with work, people having, you know, relationships in the workplace and power dynamics. And it's just, you know, thinking about where some of these ideas came from in our culture. I think you can look at Rolling Stone and the role it played in the culture. And then also, Hagan is good on the gender politics of the magazine itself and the ways that it was sexist. It's not like he doesn't hit you over the head with it, but he sort of glances at it in appropriate ways. But mostly it's just like a really fun book to read if you're, I mean, I'm not like one of those people who's super into nostalgia about the rock of the 60s and 70s. But if you were, I imagine this would be great for that. I sort of come to it from a like magazines kind of point of view. But just as a history of a time, it's fantastic. It's a real work of journalism and writing.
And Jan Wenner has had his own moment here in the, in, it's not the sun, yeah. his own moment in the darkness in this sexual harassment moment.
Well, there's like, a, yeah, there's a paragraph in this book where he's like, Jan regularly sexually harassed people in the office, but it just like comes within the culture of everyone was sleeping with everyone. It was a different time, et cetera. And like something that we would understand now as sexual harassment at the time was just like, yeah, the boss propositioned me, you know? But yes, there's a man who came forward and said that, a gay man who came forward and said that, Wenner pressured him about, I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago.
God, that is an interesting distinction to read the book. And that, cause when you read the account of that, you're like, what? It was literally like, I will offer you a contract at this magazine if you sleep with me, or I won't if you don't. You know, it's like the most explicit, like legally perfect, example of sexual harassment. And yet, in the book, it's just like, another day. In the
office, in the book, you know? It's not presented as quid pro quo. It's just like everyone is sleeping with everyone. And Jan was sort of sexually voracious is the way it's presented in the book.
Wow. Times have changed.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, that's our show for today. One more time, we urge you to call in for our annual Christmas call-in show. Christmas, I'm Jewish. Our annual holiday call-in show. June, what is the call-in number?
The call-in number is 929-266-8195.
Yes, so please call in with your questions, but that's our show for today. We thank Rachel Withers and Daniel Schrader for producing our show this week. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. We don't thank him enough anymore, so thank you, Steve. Listeners, you have been fabulous on our Facebook page, having a discussion about sexual harassment, chastising us, jumping in yourselves with your thoughts. Please keep that going. It's facebook.com/XXGapFest. We love to hear from you. So for June and Noreen, I am Hannah Rosen, and we will be back in 2 weeks.